Welcome to the Logstat, the Army's premier podcast on all things sustainment, where we analyze new developments, discuss current trends, and forge the path ahead for the next generation of sustainment soldiers. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Logstat. I'm your host, Captain Garrett Pyle. First, on this very special 4th of July episode, I'd like to say happy 4th of July to everyone out there, and also happy 250th birthday to the United States of America. What an amazing time to be alive right now. I mean, 250 years that this nation has been around. Think about throughout all our history, everything we've done, everything we've been through. Last year, we've had a couple episodes looking at the 250 years of the Quartermaster Corps overall and the Army's history of logistics over 250 years. Just truly amazing, everything that's happened. And as we were talking about a little bit ago, it's like knowing where you've come from is going to really help you to see where you're going. And that's what we're talking about today, folks, is seeing how do we make ourselves as sustainers more tactical so we can get back to the basics, understand what it means to be a tactical leader going forward. Because that's something, it gets lost sometimes on understanding, okay, getting back out there to be able to shoot, move, and communicate. So on that note, I have with me today Command Sergeant Major James LaFreda, who's going to walk us through what he sees as what it means to be a tactical sustainment leader. He is the Command Sergeant Major of the United States Army Combined Arms Command here at Fort Lee, Virginia, CASCOM. So on that note, Sergeant Major, I'm going to turn it over to you to give a little quick introduction.
Thank you, sir, very much. Thank you for having me today. So my name is Command Sergeant Major James LaFreda. I'm the current CASCOM and Sustainment Center of Excellence Sergeant Major. I came in the Army in February of 1993 as a 63 Whiskey, which is a wheel vehicle repair. We used to have five levels of maintenance, and I was a third shop mechanic. So I started, my first duty assignment was 269 Armored Battalion on Fort Benning, Georgia, and PCS there, and went to Vicenza, Italy, where I was fortunate to serve twice. The first time as a private up to sergeant, I was in the forward support company, and then I PCS'd 82nd Airborne Division following that tour. And then served in 528 Special Operations Support Battalion, and then PCS to Germany to 3rd COSCOM, where I was a fleet wheel vehicle fleet manager and a platoon sergeant. And then PCS back to Fort Bragg to serve at the Fort Bragg and 18th Airborne Corps NCO Academy. And then I PCS'd from the other side of post to go to 7th Special Force Group, where I spent about 6.5 years, and we did a BRAC move from Fort Bragg to Eglin Air Force Base. Had the good fortune to get selected to attend Class 66 at the Sergeant's Major Academy. And upon graduation, I was assigned to 173rd BSB as the Command Sergeant Major, which was in itself was pretty unique, being able to serve as a private in 20 years earlier in the same organization and later on becoming the Command Sergeant Major. So that was great. And then after that completion of that tour, I went over to 2ID Sustained Brigade in the Republic of Korea, on Camp Humphreys, and then 13th ACSC on Fort Hood, Texas. And then I had the good fortune to come here to serve as the 16th Regimental Sergeant Major for Ordnance, and now my present position here is the CASCOM CSM. So it's been a 33-year whirlwind journey. Always been a maintainer, and I'm proud of that because it has been fun. Not every moment was fun, mind you, but it was a good experience I had, and I'm glad that, as I look back, because there's a lot less of my career in front of me, as most of it's behind me. But I do think that there were a lot of great opportunities and experiences I had, and I'm happy to share them with you.
Well, thank you very much, Sergeant Major, for coming in today. And just, first of all, just an amazing career that you've had so far. You said 33 years of experience. It's always interesting to say where I'm only 32 years old.
So just a little dated there.
But just the amount of experience and all the different places that you've served at so far. And all that, the first thing I kind of want to touch on is, so you said you started your career at the same unit that you were a battalion sergeant?
Well, so I had experience before that. So okay. I was in 269 MST, support team, but I was only there for about 18 months, and I still a PFC, and I PCS'd to Vicenza in December of 1994.
Okay.
And I was there for 3 years, so I left as a sergeant and then went to 82nd Airborne Division.
Okay, but then you went back. And that's
20 years later. That's right, sir.
So tell us about that. What was that like, having said, hey, I was a private here, I became a sergeant here, and now I'm the sergeant major?
Well, somewhat euphoric and really disbelief. I can't tell you how many times I looked at the list to make sure that I was reading it properly. I mean, I even took a piece of paper on the laptop just to line it up to make sure that my name was lined up with the assignment because I thought it was too good to be true. It was my first choice, my preference. You had a list, you could preference assignments, and that was my number one, and I was fortunate to get it. It felt really good to be back there because while things had changed over 20 years, there are a lot of things that were still the same. Anybody that's been to Italy knows it's a relatively small installation. You only have really a brigade size element, and then you have other enablers there for the garrison, and then USARAF is there. But 173rd is, I guess, the most prominent organization that's there. And just to be able to be back there and to be that senior enlisted advisor for my battalion commander, to go through CTC rotations in Hohensfeld, Germany, and to go to live fire exercises in Slovenia, and then a lot of joint forcible entries throughout Europe. It was a dream assignment. I got to do a lot of things that I would never have been able to do, working with foreign partners, built some lifelong relationships that I still continue on now. And it was just probably the highlight of my career.
I mean, what an example you were to the junior soldiers that were in your formation, showing, hey, be able to sit there and talk to them, like, hey, you can, like, it's possible. Like, hey, like, I was in your shoes here, literally here, and look, you know, and like, what hard work and dedication, you know, getting through that trial and error of everything, of course, in the career, but just an inspiration to the junior enlisted you were.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I hope I was an inspiration. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that I'm happy to tell people, hey, that anything is possible. And I try to tell people when you join the Army, it's full of opportunities. And depending on what you want to do in your career, it's there. If you meet the standards, you're in good standing, the sky's the limit. But I also caution them that all those opportunities have a shelf life. Because if you wanted to become a warrant officer or a commissioned officer, after you have so much federal service, you're not able to do that without a waiver. And waivers are sometimes hard to come by. So if you want to do something, you should seize the day and take advantage of it while they have the opportunity.
Yeah, and I've always thought about, okay, I wonder if I, because I started back at Fort Hood, the 49th Transportation Battalion at 13th East, I was like, what if I ever find my way back there to where I started as a lieutenant?
So it's nice to be able to go back to kind of show you where you were mm-hmm. and then how far you've advanced in your career. And anytime someone shares that story with me, because it doesn't happen often, but it happens mm-hmm. often enough where you'll hear about it every so often. That it's great to be able to say, like, hey, I served here early on in my career, and I've seen this many things happen. And you can also give people some of the benefits of your wisdom. But we have to be careful about that, though, because sometimes we're a prisoner of our own experience.
Yep.
Sometimes things progress, and we still think, hey, this is the way it was when I was here, and it's not necessarily the way it is now. And I will tell you, in 33 years, I've seen significant amount of changes over time and space, and there's a few things that remain the same, but by and large, you have to be very adaptable to how things evolve. If we get stuck in yesteryear and romanticize about the past, we're going to miss the opportunity to be part of the future and be present in the moment.
So looking at it from, you said, you know, 33 years of experience, what have you seen when it comes in the sustainment world change over those 33 years?
So when I first came in the Army, we had five levels of maintenance. You had to operator crew maintenance, organizational maintenance, which was your folks that worked in the motor pool, direct support, which is where I worked, general support, which did more intensive repairs like paint, significant body repair. And then they had the depot where a complete overhaul was done from start to finish. They changed that with modularity, I believe sometime around 2005, 2010, in that era, I can't remember the exact date, we went to three levels of maintenance. And a lot of folks say two levels of maintenance, four levels of maintenance, but they fail to include the most critical portion, which is the operator crew, because individuals are responsible for their own piece of equipment to make sure it runs properly, that it's maintained, serviced, because that's the piece of equipment you're taking into combat, whether it's your individual weapon or if you have a 10-ton truck and everything in between. You are the operator and you are responsible for the upkeep and maintenance of that. And that means you're not ready if your equipment is not ready.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, you've probably seen your entire career, but we have to continue to hit the nail on the head constantly of like, this is, you are the operator, your name, which hopefully is on the piece of equipment, actually
yes.
on the window, like you own that. You need to take pride in it, just like you take pride in your own vehicle or your own property, you need to take pride into whatever piece of equipment that you're operating. And getting back to it, I really like how you articulated that, because even if you've seen it, sometimes that continues to get lost and we're still harping on that, because it's like a thing where people fully haven't grasped it for some reason.
Absolutely. And I will tell you, another thing I've seen is the vehicle complexity has increased significantly. I will tell you, my first assigned vehicle in the Army was an M35 Series Deuce and a Half, which if you go to the Ordnance Museum, I can show you what it looks like, because they have one there. It had a manual transmission, had a multi-fuel engine. It had manual drum brakes that worked off of hydraulics. And some of them, you know, some of the larger trucks were air assist like they are today, but it was made in 1966. It had a little data plate in it, so when it was made. And now you look at like your average motor pool now, you have JLTVs, extremely complicated piece of equipment that requires an intense understanding of systems and processes of that piece of equipment for you to be able to operate it, and not only operate it, but to diagnose and repair it correctly. So we've advanced considerably since that Vietnam era technology piece of equipment that I had to the cutting edge piece of equipment that a new soldier is going to experience when they go to their first unit of assignment. Mm-hmm.
So getting to the core of today's episode, the idea of a tactical sustainment leader, can you kind of walk us through what you define that to be?
Absolutely. So I'm happy to discuss it. I will tell you that what happens with us as sustainers, our MOSs are typically very technical focused, and they have to be, because if we're going to have a young soldier potentially repair a piece of equipment like a JLTV, they have to understand how all those systems work and what they do, and they have to be able to understand advanced troubleshooting and diagnostics, or any of the MOSs like our mariners who have to go get licensed through certain laws that require them to hold these certain certifications, licenses, before they can have that vessel go underway. But when do we find the time for it? And this is where the delicate balance is so important, is we do our job very well, by and large, for our technicians. But we don't spend time on we do familiarization and weapons qualification, but do soldiers feel comfortable and competent in their own competency, their confidence in how well they can engage targets? And how do they survive and win on tomorrow's battlefield or today's battlefield? Because today is now, it's happening. Look at what some of the things that are going on over the lessons we're seeing observed in the Ukraine, some of the things that are happening in Operation Epic Fury. It highlights the facts that sustainment forces are vulnerable. And we have to make sure that soldiers take time to dedicate time and resources to train on those tactical skills, the individual and individual and collective tasks, and gain a high level of proficiency and confidence in their abilities to treat, to navigate, to react in a chemical environment, any type of contested environment. That has to be second nature.
Now, do you feel that we, like, due to, you know, corn operations, we've lost that over the years then?
I think certainly we met the requirement. There was the mission had changed, so we met the mission, and that happened. It's not unusual for us to say, hey, we need to shift our focus on this versus that. So with counterinsurgency operations, it was very specific on how we needed to be successful, and the skills that we needed to train soldiers on, doctrine, met those needs. And we trained in the operational force to make sure that soldiers would survive and win in that environment. But the rules have changed. We have to make sure that the way we approach that also changes. If you look at, you know, UAS systems are across the battlefield, and it's a reality that we have to understand that not only is it going to continue, but we have to make sure soldiers understand how to react in that type of environment, what's changed, how vulnerable are we with these systems that are out there. Everywhere a soldier is, they're going to be able to be seen. They're going to have a signature with their cell phones, with any type of GPS system. So the enemy can spot us, and if they can see you, they can kill us. And we have to make sure soldiers understand that and get that discipline to make sure that they don't put themselves or their battle buddies in harm's way.
Yeah, it's no longer the era of giant forward operating bases.
No,
anymore.
And we're going to expect soldiers to go in very small groups to areas that are contested. And we're going to need to empower leaders to make sure that when I send a small element out, that they're going to understand what they need to do, and they're going to have to work autonomously, and they're going to have to make decisions if there's not another person there to tell them what they need to do. They need to be able to react to the situation and get the mission accomplished and get everybody back home safely.
Mm-hmm. So how do you see us accomplishing this concept of being a tactical sustainment leader?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is dedicate time and resources to training our soldiers. Nothing can happen if they don't have that good muscle memory that I mentioned earlier. It has to be inculcated in their culture. They have to see themselves as warriors. They're not just a sustainer. I'm not just a mechanic. I'm not just a culinary specialist. I am a soldier first. I am a warrior. And I have to be very comfortable with my warrior tasks and battle drills. And they have to be able to have leaders that understand that and can teach new soldiers how to survive and win. And it starts by dedicating time on the calendar for that specific purpose. 6 weeks out, using the 8-step training model, having training meetings where we deliberately protect that time. And it's on there. It's a contract between the commander and that subordinate leader to make sure that we're going to conduct this training. And we're going to do all the preliminary steps in order to make sure that that training is relevant, number one, that we validated our instructors, it's properly resourced, and we make sure that we capture the lessons learned once it's completed. And if retraining is necessary, we put that on the calendar. That discipline with making sure we do routine things routinely. And I think, unfortunately, I've seen it where when it comes to tactical things on the calendar, they fall off the calendar. And we have to make sure that in the event there's a competing requirement, which it happens a lot, we need to make sure we get that stuff back on the calendar and start the process again and make sure that we conduct that training. And it can't be a hand wave either. We have to make sure that if the training is not up to snuff, it's not up to standard, we retrain soldiers, revalidate instructors, whatever it takes. Because as a commander, and although I've never been a commander, I would want to make sure without a doubt that my soldiers can do the things I need them to do. And they're going to have to do it in a stressed, contested environment. And leaders are going to potentially get injured or killed on the battlefield, and they'll be expect the mission still has to continue. So that next person, regardless of what their rank is, has to be able to pick up and move forward.
And then going back to a few things I want to unpack there. And the first is how you talked about soldiers need to realize, hey, you are a soldier. And I think it gets back to a little bit what you're saying with the culture of the way we look at that. Back when I was an instructor here at the career course, I had one of my at a Marine. Of course, you know, we have Marine counterparts that come in for the course. And their mindset is always, hey, I'm a Marine first, whatever my job is second. And sometimes in the Army, we look at, hey, I am a maintainer, or, you know, I'm a cook, or whatever the job is, then I'm a soldier. So getting back to that mindset of I am a soldier first, then whatever my job is. And it's very fitting on being, you know, this is our 250th birthday right now, and seeing the history what our soldiers have done throughout 250 years and all the battles they fought in, and getting back to that mindset of, okay, yes, you go to basic training first to learn how to be a soldier. Then you do your advanced individual training, or like the officer side, you do your bullock. You need to get back to the idea of, okay, I am a soldier first. I am ready to, as we're talking about today, do the basic soldier, like shoot, move, and communicate, and then focus on the whatever your advanced individual task is. So just want to get your thoughts on that.
I appreciate that, because this is something I feel pretty passionate about. So myself and the CG have talked about how can we add more tactical rigor to AIT, to PME courses when folks come here for ALC, SLC, BOLIC, et cetera. How can we get that soldier experience, the soldier in the dirt, the muddy boots, how can we replicate that to a certain degree here and blend it with like a capstone event for each one of those courses? I think it's a continuation of what should be happening in the operational force. And we're using doctrine, existing doctrine, to make sure that we understand how to do things in a contested environment. This is the standard from a doctrinal perspective. Mm-hmm. And that's going to vary when you apply it to the operational force, because different missions and different organizations, mm-hmm. but at least the theory and principles that good foundation. So we want to make sure that when soldiers leave basic combat training, and they come to advanced individual training, those skills that they learn, those basic combat skills, don't atrophy over time and space, because some of our MOSs are only here for roughly 6 to 8 weeks, where we've got some others that are about 18 weeks. And that's a long time mm-hmm. for someone that's just turned into a soldier or just becoming a soldier. So we want to make sure that we continue that to continue to build on those existing skills, and then not necessarily re-blue NCOs and officers and warrant officers when they come through here, but just to validate that they understand what's expected at the med echelon and to also include some type of tactical rigor to the training.
And one of the things that I have very passionate about for myself is that the concept that it does not matter what rank you are, we are all soldiers. And it doesn't matter if you're an officer, warrant officer, NCO, like no matter what, you are a soldier. And sometimes we lose sight of that. You know, you see a lot of times people say, oh, a soldier, and they're referring to just the junior enlisted. And it creates a divide there. And get back to the concept, hey, I need to be able to get down and dirty, just like anybody else, be able to dig a foxhole if I need to. And it builds on building that relationship with those that you are serving with to know that you can trust each other. I can trust you just as much as you can trust me to put rounds down range when need to be. Now, we each have our different roles and responsibilities depending on rank and job, but getting back to those basic soldier tasks of Jen, hey, I can get out there, get on the range, qualify with my weapon. I can go out there. I can know how to do land nav. I can go out there and do individual movement techniques, whatever it may be.
Well, you're right, sir. I mean, a bullet or a UAS won't distinguish between rank. You know, it's just trying to try to kill you. Mm-hmm. And we have to make sure that soldiers, again, survive and win on today's battlefield and for the uncertainty of tomorrow. And when you, to your point earlier about the Marines, about making sure you understand you are a soldier first, you're a warrior first, and your primary function is to close with and destroy the enemy. And we have to make sure soldiers understand that from the day they raise their hand, and they go through basic combat training, through AIT, and when they show up to their first unit of assignment, and it continues on throughout their career, and they get re-emphasized at each time they go to a PME course. So I couldn't agree more.
So you talked about, you said here at CASCOM, you're looking at like, how do you make the training here, you know, more rigorous? How do you make it more on the tactical side? So what are ways that the command team here is implementing that?
Well, we looked at several things, and we certainly have a lot more work to do on trying to make sure that we bright size that. I mean, ideally, we would have a PME that would be able to accommodate making sure that we validate technical skills and then, of course, leadership skills and then apply that in a field type of exercise or a type of environment. But we're also very resource constrained. So we have to find, again, a delicate balance to find out where can we do all the things we want to do in the limited resource we have. So it does take a little bit of improvisation and creativity. We have nothing solidified as of yet, but there's still a lot of discussions on what we need to do. And we're still in the research and development phase of identifying what things does, say, for example, a staff sergeant need to know when they come through ALC before they go back to their organization, to their unit of assignment. And it should mean something. It should be a very definitive experience for the individual that attends the course. And they go back to their formation. They're able to take what they've learned and be able to apply it in their organization and share that with their subordinates. So if that kind of outlines it, I know it's a little ambiguous, but I think the intent is there. We want to make sure that soldiers are tactical, NCOs, warrant officers, commissioned officers, when they leave here, it's not just the technical focus that they receive here, but also how is it blended in a tactical situation.
But I know me and the audience fully understand, like, hey, things are in development right now. It's going to take time. As you said, it's a delicate balance. And it kind of gets into the point of you referred to earlier when it on the operational side of the house, when, hey, we put this stuff on the calendar, we're going to go out, we're going to do X, Y, and Z training, and then something bumps it. And I know on you with a maintenance background, probably saw that a lot.
Well, there were a lot of times where you would have a backlog of pieces of equipment that needed to be repaired, or as a first sergeant of a forward support company, a last minute tasking would come down and, hey, we've got to support this and it's got to get done regardless if you've got stuff on the calendar that's already been allocated and resourced. It doesn't have to get brushed away and forgotten about it. In fact, you have to re-engage that. And what we used to do years ago is we would do our training meetings and we'd have to explain to commanders training plan not conducted. And you had to have a very good reason why that training didn't occur. And it always had a conversation embedded in that discussion of when are you going to do the training that you said you were going to do? Because the soldiers, by and large, they like that type of training. They want to go out and do something different. They join the Army to be soldiers. And that means, you know, firing their individual and crew serve weapons, gaining proficiency, putting on their protective gear, going out and doing those soldier type things in a field environment so they can have that confidence in their abilities and their leaders that they're going to make sure that if something happens, My leadership is going to make sure I'm trained as much to the highest standard so we can make sure that we survive and win on the combat in combat and make everybody bring home everybody safely.
Okay. So as Rick, we're kind of, you know, continuing this conversation, understand that word tactical and how you're working to implement it here at, you know, CASCO with the PME and trying to get it, you know, with on the operational side of the house. You know, it's all about, you know, as you said, finding that balance. So with all that, how do you see, you know, when you're out there in the operational force, how do you find that balance more? Like, you know, I know you just talked about it a little bit, but how do you find that balance?
It's difficult, without question. And that's, you know, as leaders, you know, we get hard challenges. Otherwise, if we just solve an easy challenge, they're probably for someone else to solve, right, a junior. But, you know, you have to have a parasitic approach to training because let's say, for example, you're doing a support mission to support Unit X, right? Because we're always the supporting unit. We're not the supported unit as sustainers. So what opportunities can I get after some of those critical tasks for my section, whatever the squad, team, platoon, company, and nest it within that training exercise? Even simple things like doing PCCs, PCIs for corporals, specialists, young sergeants, get that routine to make sure you put all your soldiers in formation, you make sure that they're wearing all their proper kit, they're wearing it to the standard, that the vehicles are ready, dispatches, all the stuff that you have to do to get out of the motor pool, to make sure the vehicle is going to roll out safely, that it's got all the protective gear and all the Pioneer tools, the fire extinguishers, et cetera, those type of things. And you build that repetition and it'll do a couple of things. It'll create discipline in the process where soldiers, if you're not checking something, I think Napoleon said this quote, what's not inspected is neglected. So if you don't inspect things, soldiers, it's just going to atrophy and you're going to have soldiers leaving the motor pool with vehicles that should never have left the motor pool in the first place because either unsafe because of a maintenance or safety issue, or they don't have the proper equipment if they have to pull off to the side of the road, the triangle, that sort of thing. A host of different things can happen. Soldiers will be missing, you know, something that may seem insignificant, like a soldier doesn't have their ID tags. You know, it's not the fact that they're missing their ID tags. It's the fact that nobody checked to make sure that the soldier didn't have their ID tags and they didn't enforce the standard and say, you need to have your ID tags. That's the problem. And I think some folks don't see it that way. But if you're not checking something, then you can just assume that it's not going to be there when you need it.
That is so critical, Sergeant Major.
And I know I've oversimplified it, but you know, if you're going out to do some type of maintenance recovery operation, there's a different things you need to do, like route reconnaissance, map reading, you know, navigate, you know, how are you going to get from point A to point B, you know, the approach to the recovery site, making sure you remain in like a tactical formation. All of those things are extremely good opportunities for you to work with your team, have that senior non-commissioned officer and platoon leader talking about making sure how are you going to do this. And if you were to approach things like that, if you operationalize everything you do, you would start to see a change in how soldiers have that mindset. To get back to what we talked about, the warrior mindset, operationalize even the routine and the most routine things that you do will start to make a difference.
Yeah, it's as simple as you got your motor pool Mondays, like do vehicle rollouts.
That's it.
It's just as simple. I mean, you go out there, you do your quick PMCS on it. Oh, I said, no, not quick, but you do your PMCS on it and go out, get miles on those vehicles. Go out there, do a roll, do a small convoy, reps and sets, as you talked about.
And then it just becomes second nature where it's not this unfamiliar sensation when we have to do a convoy. Soldiers know what they're supposed to do, and we use backwards planning to make sure that we had all those SP times where you don't want to miss an SP time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, especially like places like Korea where you have, or Europe for that matter, we have limited opportunities to be on the roads. So it's critical that you make those SP times. And if you do all the backwards planning and you create that culture of accountability and you create that disciplined initiative for leaders to make sure that they go out and they make those checks. So when it does come time to roll out of the motor pool, not only are you doing it on time, but you're doing it in the right uniform and having all the things you need to do to make it successful.
Yeah, we've talked about on this show before about like, it shouldn't just be your vehicles on Monday. Like you have other equipment that you need to.
So you have radios, you have GPS, you have weapons systems, you have all different types of things that a lot of times just, you know, we gravitate towards the vehicles. And I think that that's an opportunity missed a lot of times. And I've seen organizations where they'll focus like, on this Monday, we're going to focus on individual crew serve weapons. So everybody falls into the motor pool, to the arms room. They draw the equipment. They do a PMCS, make sure it's clean, serviceable, and turn everything back in, get accountability for it. And it's no different than anything else with communication systems, like making sure that, you know, another opportunity to do operationalize a routine event is to, you know, when they do the guide-ons, and each one of the organizations responds in sequence to make sure whose radio works, who knows how to set the radio up in the first place. And if you've got problems, great time to figure it out before you need the system.
Mm-hmm. So what would your kind of advice be for someone like, let's say maybe a junior NCO or like a platoon for like their weekly sergeant's time training, leader's time training, like, how do they maximize that time to get to the tactical side?
Well, I think you got to take a look at, you know, what is on the training calendar that already exists, because it's a competition for space on the calendar. And I believe the statement, there's never white space on the calendar. There is always something that has to happen. But when you're given times like PT and you're given times like command maintenance and leader time training, those are your opportunities where you can make a decision on what you're going to have happen in your formation. And I believe, like, for a platoon leader and platoon sergeant to sit down and kind of map that out, make sure it's nested with the higher headquarters on what they intend, because they may have a specific set of priorities that they want to have for each of the weeks, and just make sure that you maximize those opportunities. Anytime you plan and resource something, it's always going to go a lot better than if you just try to improv.
You just don't go off the hip.
Yeah, I mean, you might be successful, but I think you increase your odds significantly if you plan it out and you have that methodical approach.
Okay. So what would you be, like, you were talking to, like, a team leader then? Like, because there's times, as we all know, you're waiting around the motor pool for whatever you happen. How do we, as, like, I know, a team leader, maximize that time?
Well, so we waste a lot of time. I hate to say it, but that's the truth. Like, when you go to a range, for example, we used to do concurrent training. So you would go out, you do a normal weapons qualification, zero weapons qualification. You'd have the tent off to the side if it was for inclement weather. Or you always have a time where you would have folks that were on the firing line qualifying or getting ready to go on the qualifying line. And then when they're either waiting to go into the that line to get on the range, or they've just completed their time on the range, there should be some other training event out there. So soldiers aren't just out there looking at their phones or just sitting around idle. And that's such an opportunity wasted I don't want to say lost art of leadership, because I don't think it's lost. I just think it's forgotten. I think we just need to refamiliarize ourselves with it. It wasn't unusual back in the 90s. And I don't want to romanticize the past, but you go out there and we'd have seaburn training. You would have, you know, putting your mask on properly, putting on all levels of MOP gear, or doing first aid. And it kind of gave you that mindset that we're trying to achieve, you know, that warrior mentality to make sure that this is very real, what you're doing in this profession of arms we have to support and defend the Constitution. And at some time it may require us to inflict violence on our adversaries. So we have to make sure that we're ready for that. And it's going to happen, and we're not going to have a lot of notice. We're going to have to just go out there and execute. And you have to make sure that when you and your soldiers leave to go deploy, you don't have regrets saying, I wish I trained them on this or that, because there are opportunities. You just have to be very creative and look at it. So when I hear about people just sitting around the motor pool waiting for formations and stuff like that, I'm bothered by that, because there's opportunities. When you've done everything, have you really done everything?
Yeah. We don't want to be missing those opportunities to maximize it.
Even if you're talking through with your soldiers, like, hey, this is what we're doing tomorrow. We're getting ready to have this range on Thursday. Let's talk about what's going to happen. Let's identify times on the calendar where we're going to do preliminary inspections and final inspections, all those things. There is time if we know how to use it properly.
And you mentioned, soldiers have to be able to get out there and give violence to the enemy. I can't remember exactly how you said it just now, but I think as sustainers, sometimes that gets lost. The mindset is, I am this MOS, or like, I'm a maintainer, or, you know, maybe I work at the SSA. That's never going to happen to me.
Well,
we lose that.
So recorded history has a lot of instances where that has been proven wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, most recently, we had a rocket attack that just happened in Operation Epic Fury, where two sustainers were killed. Right here on Fort Lee, there's a monument for the 14th Quartermaster Detachment that were all killed I think all in total, I think 13 soldiers died in that stray rocket attack. So things like that could happen. But more to your point, when you're on the road in a convoy, you're going to get aggressed because sustainment formations are usually large, somewhat cumbersome because most of our vehicles are very large and a great prime target for our adversary. Because if you want to stop a tank, you don't want to go head on against it. You want to cut off its fuel supply and its ammunition supply. And that's what our sustainers are doing, is they're bringing that stuff to the fight. So we have to realize that we have to be able to defend ourselves. So that means that we have to master crew-serve weapons and convoy protection platforms, and to be able to be ready in case we're aggressed, and what we do when we are aggressed. So that goes back to what I said earlier about muscle memory. What happens if your truck is hit? What happens if the driver goes down? What happens if you have to engage the enemy? Things like that. How are we going to blow past this obstacle? Those type of things that are really rapidly starting to be depleted out of our formations, because you're starting to see less and less Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom vets in the formation. And we have to make sure that we dedicate time and resources to that type of training. And if we don't get it right, we go back and do it again. And it's progressive. Mm-hmm. You know, you start out with just going through the convoy lanes a couple of times, and then you transition to blank ammunition and then live ammunition. So we have to make sure that we set the conditions early on. And it goes back to what I said earlier, making sure soldiers know how to wear their kit properly. Leaders are inspecting, vehicles are maintained. All of those things lead up to that one capstone event to make sure they go through that convoy live fire. And that's just one example. We're starting to see now that the large base cluster, the large BSA formations are just a huge target with UAS systems. And we've got to change how we do that. How will we support, like, the smallest element possible forward is going to go. And again, this goes back to having leaders that can think on their own, to empower junior non-commissioned officers and junior leaders to be able to think and act when they're working autonomously. We have to inculcate that kind of culture, that warrior culture that we've talked about, that mindset, in order for us to be able to survive and win. And you'll hear me say survive and win, because it's not just surviving. We want to still be able to thrive and win and defeat our adversaries.
That's one of the terms we use a lot in Alaska or in the Arctic, was we're not just here to survive, we're here to thrive.
That's it.
And because I was, so much of my career I've, being up in the Arctic and just seeing that, but that was just that mindset is, because, well, one up there, it's not just the enemy, the environment, Mother Nature is trying to kill you up there.
So that's the other thing. We had our normal this week in history, we talked about the Aleutian Island campaign, mm-hmm. and how soldiers really suffered more from the cold and the environment than they did from enemy contact. And I think it's unfortunate that we continuously relearn that lesson. So we have to make sure that, although I've never had the pleasure to serve in Alaska or 10th Mountain Division, do soldiers even understand how to use all the proper layers of protection that the Army issues them? You know, how do you use your sleeping bag? All those simple, they seem simple enough, but if people don't understand that and they don't validate that they know what they're doing, then soldiers are going to get injured and potentially perish. And we certainly don't want that to happen. And you can't do your job. You can't survive and win if you're not able to do your job because your fingers are frozen or you have frostbite or some other type of cold weather injury. And the same could be said for hot weather climates. You know the environment and understand the risks inherent with that environment and be able to use the mitigating factors so you can still continue to move forward and do your job.
Oh, yes. We always joked up there. It was like, if you can do it in the Arctic, you can do it anywhere, because it had such a complex layer to it with everything being frozen.
Right. So absolutely right. We're seeing a lot of the new technology that we send to cold weather climates. You know, what is working, what's not, what mitigating factors we have to use to have that piece of equipment ready when we need it. So I think it's extremely important for any new teammates that have never been in an environment like that, or for someone that hadn't been there in a while, to kind of re-blue them on some of those things. I think it's easy for those skills to atrophy, just like what we've been talking about, you know, those combat skills over time. You PCS from here to there and you have different assignments and different missions. You've got to kind of go back with almost like a fresh set of eyes and what's changed and what's mm-hmm. stayed the same. And can I survive and win?
And it goes back to, we talked a lot about reps and sets, because if you don't use it, you lose it.
That's it.
with so many of our skills, and as we're, you know, closing up today on this concept of being a tactical sustainment leader, being a tactical sustainment soldier, is understanding, like, changing that cultural mindset to say, hey, we are a warrior first, and we got to be able to do these basics leader's skills. We got to be able to shoot, move, and communicate. So as we close up today, is there anything that we missed that you wanted to highlight to the community on how do we get after that?
It's going to be different everywhere you go. Every organization is going to have different priorities. But what's important is to remember is that desire to make sure that your soldiers have the proper training. And this is really for all the leaders. You've got to fight for that time to be protected on the calendar. There's always going to be something else that needs to be done. And that's fine if you don't get to do the training when you want to do it, but you still have to do the training. It doesn't magically go away. So you've got to continuously fight for those times, because time is our most precious resource. And we don't know how much of it we're going to have until we find ourselves in the next conflict. So I ask leaders to just be patient, stay the course, and continue to make sure that that time gets protected on the calendar. And if for whatever reason it has to be shifted, fight to get it back on there to complete the training. And don't just hand wave it either. Right? Because what will happen is, well, we did this training and it was mediocre. No, if it's not tough, realistic, and it doesn't replicate to the closest degree you can without crossing over the line of safety, then it's probably not effective. And the soldiers need, they deserve that. That's what we as leaders do. That's why we do what we do, is we owe it to the soldiers to give them the best training we can to replicate as close as we possibly can to the reality of combat.
And on the concept of time, and not, if you haven't achieved your objective, you need to build into your training calendar of, like, we didn't achieve this, we need to get another rep or set into this. Because this, as you said, you don't want to hand wave it. Get back out there and do another rep.
That's right, sir. Because, you know, it's okay to fail in a training environment, because that's how you learn. And we have to not be afraid of failing. Like, something didn't work out perfectly. It's an opportunity to say, hey, here's what we did. Here's what we can do better. Let's try it again. I worked for a CG once. He said, let's make new mistakes. And you might hear that and you might kind of laugh a bit, but honestly, don't do the same things wrong each time. Do something different and try some different things that are going to have different outcomes. Hopefully they'll have successful outcomes, but continue to try to do things with the attitude of continued improvement. Not necessarily perfection, because the pursuit of perfection is a fool's errand, but to continuously improve on what you do.
Exactly. And I think we get too much in that mindset. Like, I have to be 100% green. I have to be 100% trained. Like, we look at it going to the range and doing crew serves. And we talk about trying to balance the training. And sometimes you get out there like, hey, this is this team's first time on the 50 cal. And that's an interesting weapon to qualify on. And it's okay to look at, okay, we didn't get qualified this time, but we got that familiarization. We got more hands-on. And now we go back out again.
That's
better.
Absolutely true.
And get better.
There's no reason why you couldn't call another organization and say, hey, I have one crew that has to get validated on this piece of equipment, or they need to go out and certify, or whatever the case may be, because it's going to happen. Some soldiers, for whatever reason, that could be a mechanical failure or just lack of training or lack of familiarity, lack of confidence. You fill in the blanks, but they got to get out there and keep doing it until at least they meet the standard.
Exactly. And the fear is, that I have sometimes is, if we hand wave this train and say, oh, I'm green on the slide, we have now put that soldier, that team in detriment.
Yeah, it's almost criminal to think someone would do that. And it takes real courage to say, my team is red, and here's why they're red, and here's why they're not ready. A candid, honest assessment. Because you might get away with it, and the next couple of leaders might get away with it, but at some point, there's going to be a time where that is going to be tested in the unforgiving crucible of combat. And I will tell you that when sons and daughters of America are depending on you to make sure that you train them properly, it's a very heavy weight, and you don't want to hand wave it. You can't. Yeah. It's criminal if we do that.
Exactly, Sergeant Major. That's why it's so critical as we close out today's conversation on tactical sustainment leaders, is we got to put that value on training these soldiers across our formation, because as you talked about, like, we're leading America's men and women in the combat, and they're going to look to us as leaders, the senior leaders, have you trained them well? And you never want to have that mindset of, like, I wish I would have done more training.
Absolutely.
Or, as you said, it's like, it's criminal to say, oh, we got a green on the slide, we're good to go. When in actuality, that team wasn't trained properly enough, and heaven forbid something happens because of that. So we got to have tough, realistic training in everything that we do. We've had some great conversations today about that, how to implement that, both, you know, ways we're looking to do it here at the PME, as well as from the operational side. And we're just going to continue to get after that tough, realistic training across the board. And as we close out today, what advice do you have for the systemic community? You know, that's something I want to ask all my guests, because especially for you, you know, 33 years of wisdom, you've seen a lot. So what kind of, from all of that time, what can you tell the systemic community?
So I will tell you that I've had the pleasure to serve with a lot of great individuals. And I think when I reflect on some of the leaders that were really tough on me coming up, that were uncompromising when it came to training, I'm thankful for it, because I relied on that to get through some tough challenges. And that, as a senior leader, that's kind of what I expected of all my subordinate leaders, is to do the same thing, is to spend time training your soldiers and making sure they're ready. And the best way to take care of soldiers is not to give them time off or not give them awards, is to make sure that they are very well trained. And I think that if you're not looking at the things like that through those lenses, I ask you to reconsider. So again, we are potentially on the verge of going to war right now. We always are. And it's a very dangerous time. And I think that you're not gonna have time after the fact. You have to spend every minute you can in investing and making sure that our soldiers are well trained. And I know I keep saying the same thing, but I really want to harp on that point and emphasize it, because it's just so important.
Exactly, Sergeant Major. So on that note, where can people reach out to you then? You'd be able to send their cards and letters. They can be like, hey, Sergeant Major, I got a question. You talked about this on the podcast. I want to follow back up. So how can they find you?
Well, the fastest way is to just send me an email, because there's only one Sergeant Major LaFrada, so I'm relatively easy to find on the global. If you want to just reach out through an email, feel free to do that. We can set up a time. We can have a telephone call, or if you're in the local area, we'll dedicate some time and space on the calendar for a good discussion, because I want to hear what you're thinking and I want to give you my perspective. I caution the word wisdom, because I don't consider that. I'll give you a perspective. I will share my perspectives over my time in the military, and it may be helpful to you. I hope it is. And I just want everybody to be successful in this challenging profession that a lot of people just won't take the challenge of being a soldier. And I appreciate the time to talk to you today, sir. Thank you.
Of course, Sergeant Major. I'm so happy to have you on the show today.
Thank you.
So there you have it, folks. Another episode as we wrap up. And on this 4th of July weekend, I want you to just get out there, you know, look back throughout history. You know, we talked today a lot about on the tactical side for sustainers and what it means to be a tactical leader, be a tactical soldier in the systemic community, and why that's so important. And just look back throughout history, you know, the achievements, not just across the Army as a whole, but within the systemic community. And as you celebrate with your friends and family during this time, and it's an amazing time to celebrate. 250 years, that is an achievement. And look back, pull off a book off the shelf, read some articles about where we've been. You know, the Army as a whole has been throughout. So it's just a rich history. But look throughout the systemic community. See the different, you know, objectives they have achieved throughout their time, throughout each of the branches, but also see where we're going. And that's what's great about this podcast, is we're seeing both where we've been and where we are going. And we talked about today on the way ahead on how to be a tactical sustainer. So take that out to your formation. See how you, within your formation, can get better at the basics, get better at being a tactical soldier, shoot, move, and communicate, maximize your time. We talked a lot today about not having wasted time. Find time on the counter. It's as simple as, hey, don't be just standing around in the motor pool. You know, we talk about, hey, we got Line of Departure, the website, you know, where all the Army's articles and podcasts are listed out, is out as an app. So if you haven't yet, get the app. So if you're just standing around, you can just pull that up. You're like, hey, what new articles are happening? What new things are happening? You can right then and there have an LPD based off whatever the current article is. So check out Line of Departure. It is an app now available across all app platforms. Utilize that as a quick LPD, you know, as you're just waiting around in the chow line. You don't have to just directly go to your web browser. You can pull it up now. You get notifications on new articles based on the branch, especially for those out there, as we talked about, we're always supporting somebody. So if you're not sitting there reading about the articles coming from the branch that you're supporting, i.e. if you're out there supporting an infantry battalion or an armor or whatever it is, see what's happening in their community, because you're the one supporting them, to see how you can better support them by understanding what new innovations that they have going on. So as we close out today, Once again, have a happy 4th of July, happy 250 years once again to America. Get out there, celebrate, have a wonderful, safe time. We can't wait to see you again. But that is all we have today, folks. As always, Sustainment Leaders Start Here. See you next time. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Logstat. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Please share this episode across your formation and leave us a review. If you have a topic you'd like here discussed, then please reach out to us at armysustainment@army.mil or directly to me on global at garrett.h.pyle. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at the U.S. Army CASCOM page. We'll see you next time. Sustainment Leaders Start Here.